Sorry again for the late start. This is amazing. Only Jewish women want to learn Torah. What's going on over here? There's something wrong with the Jewish people these days. So, Parshas Va'eda contains the first major communication from God to the Jewish people. First major communication. See, in Parshas Shmos, Moshe Rabbeinu, who is a humble shepherd, is selected by God. And God says, you should tell the people, Pokoid Pokadati. Two words. Pokoid Pokadati. I have remembered you. And the Mefarshim explain that before Yosef passed on, he said, Pokoid Yifkoid Elikim Eschem. God is going to remember you. So before God will take you out of Mitzrayim, will be remembered. And this was like the magic mantra that everybody passed on from generation to generation. Pokoid Pokadati. Pokoid. Remember, Pokoid Pokadati. As somebody once told me that Moshe Rabbeinu was an individual who stammered and he had a very difficult time speaking. And the most difficult thing to say is two P's in a row. Like picked a pipe pepper, you know, that whole tongue twister. Pokoid Pokadati, a man who stammers excessively and cannot speak clearly, but when he had to say these two words, he said Pokoid Pokadati, and that was very clear. Okay? So the Jewish people got the sign. It's like you got the code, the secret code. The words didn't have to mean anything. It didn't have to mean they were remembered. It didn't have to mean they understood. That was the word. If he said the word, he said, what's the password? Pokoid Pokadati. He's the man. He's the man. Okay? He didn't really tell them very much. He just said, God remember you. Now, in this week's Parsha, after Moshe Rabbeinu is extremely distraught, not only at not having succeeded, but having made things significantly worse, and he expresses himself and his frustration and his angst before God, HaKadosh Baruch Hu now begins to address Moshe Rabbeinu's issues, the question, why, the big question, why the suffering, why the difficulty, why the travail, why the exile, why is this all happening? And God says to him, Va'edel Avram, I revealed myself to Avram, to Yitzchak, to Yaakov, but they didn't know me the way you're going to know me, and they didn't receive that kind of revelation. And so, after God having spoken to Moshe Rabbeinu and invoked the memory of our ancestors and the promise and the guarantee that he made to them. So subsequent to this, God says to the Jewish people, to Moshe Rabbeinu, Lochein emor livnei Yisrael. Therefore, you shall say to the Jewish people. And here we have two stirring verses that contain no less than four different expressions of geulah, of redemption. Vahitzesi, vihitzalti, vilakachti, vigo'alti. I'm going to take you, I'm going to redeem you, I'm going to save you. Four different expressions. Moshe Rabbeinu now had lines. This is the first time he's really going to give a speech. He didn't give a speech before. He just did a show and tell. He said, God sent me. Pokoid Pokadati. They said, wow, you know the magic password. Can you show us something? I said, oh yeah, sure, I can show you something. And he showed them through the staff on the ground that became a snake. He put his hand inside his bosom and he took it out. It was white. And he put his hand, it was skin again. So, really, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't make a speech yet. This is the first sermon ever delivered to the Jewish people before they were even a nation by the first rabbi, Moshe Rabbeinu. And the first sermon is dictated by God. God wrote the speech. God said to Moshe, here's your lines. Here's what you're going to say. You're going to say, Ani Hashem. You're representing God. Here's what God said. He's going to take the Jewish people out from underneath the burdens of Egypt. So I'm not going to talk about this verse in great detail tonight. There's a lot to be said about it, and it's understood on many different levels. The obvious question is, why do you have to say the same thing four times in a row? Of course, there are those who would argue that every sermon is the same thing again and again and again. That's the way it's been. Moshe Rabbeinu repeats himself four times. Of course, rabbis will tell you that if they don't repeat themselves four times, nobody knows anything they said a half hour later. If they repeat it four times, maybe people come away with something. But really, the Torah measures every word, we have to understand. why these four lashonis, why these four different languages. There's many explanations. But let me just point out, this is the first time we get an inkling that the Jewish people must have been speaking Hebrew. Because how else would Moshe Rabbeinu give them a speech? He just got his lines to read. So God said, here's what you should say. Here, read the lines. Whether Moshe memorized it or read it from a paper, we'll never know. But clearly, Moshe Rabbeinu had a speech to give. So with regard to this, we have a very interesting Medrash Rabba. The Medrash is found both in Shir HaShirim Rabba as well as in Bamidbar Rabba. And the Medrash talks about by what merit did the Jewish people leave exile and Mitzrayim? How did they earn the Exodus? And the Medrash talks about different virtues they had. Remember, they were idolaters. They worshipped idols. They didn't worship God. They certainly weren't eating kosher food. Nobody had a mezuzah. Whatever the ancestors did for tefillin wasn't being done anymore. I mean, these were not observant Jews. These were people who remembered that they came from a nice family, who remembered that there were family traditions, but that was about it. This is the first, and for that matter, the last time that cultural Judaism could ever last for more than two centuries. Cultural Judaism does not even last for a century today. If people are culturally Jewish, within 100 years, or oftentimes far shorter, one of two things will happen. Either the grandchildren will return to Torah and mitzvahs, and they will become part of the Jewish people, or there will be no Jewish grandchildren. It's very simple. Bagels and lox, it doesn't work. Dancing Ahura, it's not going to work. It never has worked. It's never going to work. The one time it worked was before Matan Torah. Here we had the Jewish people in the land of Mitzrayim, who had sunk into the lowest levels of deprivation and degradation, not only materially, physically, terrestrially, but also spiritually. They had lost all of the traditions and legacy. But the Medrash says they held on to four things. Oh, the four things. So one of them is, Shelo Shinu Es Lashonam. They didn't change the language. How do we know they didn't change the language? So the Medrash says the following. We see in the book of Genesis and Sefer Bereishis, when the Pulit comes to Avraham, the Pulit, of course, is Og, according to most opinions. Not everybody says that, but according to most opinions, the Pulit is Og. Og comes to Avraham Avinu, and he says to him, your nephew, he's been captured. Don't you want to do something about that? And Og hopes that Avraham, in fact, he bets that Avraham will say, it's my nephew, it's my family. I know he's been captured because he's a visible Jew or connected to me, and therefore I have to go, I have to save him. And Og bets that Avraham will go, foolishly. Avraham will be killed, and then Og has his eyes on Sarah. So he's got a whole plan in place. Of course, the plan doesn't work that way. Avraham Avinu does indeed go rescue Lot, and of course he returns home triumphantly. So the Pasuk in Genesis 14, verse 13 says, Vayavai ha-polit, the polit came, Vayaged la-Avraham ha-Ivri. He told to Avraham the Ivri, the name Yehudi, which we use for Jew, did not yet exist. How could it exist? Even Yehuda didn't exist yet. The name Yisrael, or Yisraeli, did not exist, because Avraham Avinu doesn't even have a child yet. He doesn't have Yitzchak. There's definitely no Yaakov. There's no Yisrael. So what name did Avraham have? With what was his demarcation? What was the title? How did people refer to him? He was different. What did they call him? The answer is they called him an Ivri. Okay, so called him an Ivri. And Medrash says, when Moshe Rabbeinu introduces himself to the Pharaoh, and he says, I'm here with a mission. And Medrash says, really, what's your mission? He says, well, Elokei ha'ivrim nikra olenu. The God of the Hebrews, the Ivrim, has happened upon us. And so, we would assume that Avraham, who was called an Ivri, is now somehow being linked or connected to the people who had descended from him, millions of them, by the way, living in the land of Egypt as slaves, and they're called Ivrim, Because he says, the God of the Ivrim, the God of the Hebrews, which is the first time we actually have our nation identified by name. So we have the founder of our nation identified with a title, and the title is Ivri. We have the nation identified and the name of this nation, which doesn't really exist yet. It's not really an independent nation. It's metaphorized as a pregnancy. It's part of the, it's a gestational reality. You're kind of swallowed up in the reality of Egypt and the belly of Egypt, but there's this distinct people or distinct nation somehow, a non-nation. And what are they called? They're called Ivrim. That's very nice. So how do you know that means they spoke Hebrew? I mean, who says that's about a language that was spoken? That's an identifying mark. Avraham was called Avraham the Ivri. What does that have to do with Hebrew? The people were called Hebrews. Why were they called Hebrews? I don't know. That's what they were called. That was a name. That was a name that got stuck. They didn't yet have the term Yisraeli or Yehudi. So they're called Hebrews. They could have been called Yosefites, but they weren't. They were called Hebrews. So the question becomes, how do we know that Ivri is actually an identifying mark of a language that was spoken? Now the Medrash is trying to prove that the Jewish people in the land of Egypt, after 210 years of not doing anything particularly Jewish, were still speaking Hebrew, still had their own distinct, separate language. That doesn't usually happen. People assimilate. You know, the Italian radio used to have hundreds of thousands of listeners across Ontario. There are no numbers like that anymore. There's a very small and dwindling number of people who are still speaking Italian and need Italian programming. Guess what? Most of the programs on that radio in Chin FM, they're not in Italian anymore. The Jewish hour used to be in Yiddish. Sam Yuchtman spoke in Yiddish. They don't have a Jewish hour in Yiddish anymore. Why not? Because nobody's looking for Yiddish. Nobody wants to listen to the radio in Yiddish. And the Hasidim who only speak Yiddish, they don't listen to the radio. So, and so it is. So it is. Chinese radio is very, very powerful today, but in two generations from now, it's not going to be. The reality is you come to a country, you assimilate. Now, how have we not assimilated? There's only one way we don't assimilate. Only one way. That's because we have Yiddishkeit. We have Torah mitzvahs. So Torah mitzvahs enables us not to assimilate. But culture? Culture gets assimilated. How would you imagine that the people would kind of stand their ground and say, no, we insist on speaking Hebrew? The young generation always wants to fit in. The young generation doesn't want to be different. They don't want to be foreigners. And in the beginning, we weren't slaves. In the beginning, we were welcomed. That's how Pharaoh kind of sweet-talked us into this. That's part of the imagery of the Seder, is this idea of Pharaoh sweet-talking us. That's where the maror starts off sweet. That's the sweet lettuce, because it's got a bitter root. It doesn't start off that way. So what do you think the children wanted? They wanted to be cool. They wanted to be Egyptian. They wanted to fit in. And surely they would have been speaking the Egyptian language. So here is what the Medrash remonstrates. The Medrash is like this. We find in the book of Bereishis, and here we're going to go now to Yosef, speaking to his brother. His brothers, after he acknowledges who he is, he says the following. And Yosef, so on and so forth, and then they shrink, they move back, and Yosef begins to embrace his brothers, and he says to them, "V'hine einechem ro'ot." This is Genesis 45, chapter verse 12. Your eyes see, v'eine achi Binyamin, and the eyes of your brother Binyamin, the only one who I have nothing against. He didn't sell me. Ki pi hamedaber aleichem. So how did Yosef identify himself to them? What was his identifying mark? Ki pi hamedaber, because he spoke the language. Rashi says, the first thing it says, Einechem ro'is, your eyes see. It's very hard to see words. It's very hard to see language spoken. In fact, that only happened once when the Torah was given. It says, Roye mesanishma v'shoyim mesanira. And that's a subject for another day, but the Torah was given, they heard what's usually seen, and they saw what's usually heard. But you don't see a Doppler effect. You don't see the sound waves. So Rashi's first interpretation is he showed them that he too was circumcised. Which is kind of odd, because all of Egypt was circumcised. So how would that be a proof? Yosef was the one who got all of Egypt to get circumcised. So the guy who probably got everybody else to do it maybe did it himself too. So therefore Rashi says, gives us another interpretation. The first interpretation follows the words Einechem Rois. He could actually show them something, something they could see with their eyes. And then he says, but it says, Einechem Rois, what does your eye see? It says, your eye see, Kifi HaMedaber, you see my mouth talking. So therefore, Rashi says, quoting the Bereshis Rabbah, HaMedaber, Pi HaMedaber Elechem, the mouth that's speaking to you, B'loshoin HaKodesh, in the holy tongue. So Yosef, when he had to identify himself as Yosef HaIvri, I'm part of you, what was the methodology he used? The language. The language. So this is what most of the Mefarshim say, that that means speaking the Hebrew language. And from this, the Medrash says, so you see, just as Yosef was identified by virtue of language, and we know for a fact that Jewish people didn't circumcise themselves in Mitzrayim because that's the mitzvah they did when they left. So there's no way anybody could say it possibly means that. And the Medrash doesn't say that. That's clearly not the case. So what must it mean? We have a people, an individual, a founder of a nation. He's identified as Avraham HaIvri. We have a nation identified later, many years later. And they're identified over two centuries later as HaIvrim. In the middle we have Yosef, who identifies himself as part of that clan, and the way he does so is by virtue of language that he speaks. Yes?
That's already 100 years before.
It's 200 years before. It's 210 years before. Because the Jewish people didn't, the Hebrews did. So that's what Rashi says, and many of the other Mefarshim say this. Now the Ramban asks a very, very strong question. He says, Pi hamedaber aleichem? You see, I speak Hebrew. You see, I speak Hebrew, just like you. So Ramban says, yeah, Rashi says that, Ibn Ezra says that, Radak says that. It's based on Targum Unkelus, he says, actually. That's what Unkelus says. He says, that's nice, but the Unkelus says, Ari bilshonchoin ono mimalel. I speak your language. Speak your language. That's the identifying mark. But Ramban says, I have to tell you, I don't really see how that's an identifying mark. He says, maybe what Yosef was saying was, this was like what's called an amatla. An amatla means sometimes people say things which are not exactly clear proofs. But, you know, you make an argument. You try to bolster or solidify or strengthen the point that's being made. But it's not really a good argument. He says, Yosef was trying to see. See, he says, I even speak your language. Why isn't it a good proof? He says, Einenu raya sheyedaber adam echad b'mitzrayim b'lashon hakodesh. It doesn't prove anything if somebody speaks Hebrew. Ki al dati, that's what Ramban says. In my humble opinion, says Ramban, I believe that that is Sfat Kanan. What language did the Canaanites speak? He says they probably spoke Hebrew. That's where they came from. Spoke Hebrew. So probably if the people, it wasn't just Avraham's family who spoke Hebrew. The locals, the indigenous people spoke Hebrew. So Ramban says if they spoke Hebrew, he says Avraham couldn't have brought the Hebrew from Ur Kasdim, from Haran, because in Ur Kasdim and Haran, what language did they speak? Aramit. Lavan is an Arami. So he says, it can't be Avram's language. Avram had to learn this language when he came to Canaan. And if Avram learned the language when he learned to Canaan, he says, how far is Egypt from Israel? Or those days Canaan. How far is it? It's really not very far. Ask the Israeli soldiers, Nebuch, who had to defend Israel on Yom Kippur when the Egyptians came pouring across the border. It was pathetic. And even when you're walking, it's not very... It's right a walk through what they call the Philadelphia Corridor. It's very close. So he says, if it's very close, it's likely that people spoke the language. Do you know that a significant portion of people in Southern California speak? Spanish. And in New Mexico.
and in Texas. You know why? Because he didn't build his wall yet, that's why. because people live next to Mexico. They, if we spoke Canadian, the people in upstate New York would speak Canadian too, or at least we would speak English. It's not uncommon when there's cross-border that there's a cross-border influence. People live in proximity, so invariably, customs, conventions, language, it's exchanged. Egypt's very close. And Ramban suggests, if that's Lashon Kanaan, Rabim bin Mitzrayim Yoidim Oiseki Karavu. Because of the geographic closeness, it must be that many people spoke Hebrew. They spoke the Canaanite language or languages. And Ramban proves this. He says, had Nebuchadnezzar speak Hebrew? Nebuchadnezzar spoke Hebrew. He gave the Jews a speech in Hebrew. Not like Bill Clinton, Chavera Tachaseri, managed the three words. He gave a little speech in Hebrew. He could speak the language. There are many Arabs, incidentally, who speak Hebrew today. Not just because they live in Israel. It's not so different, and it's in proximity. So really, Ramban says, if you ask me, he says, I think the really strong proof was that he knew the name Yosef. How would he know the name Yosef? He knew everything. He knew all about them. He said, this brother of yours never ever gave his name. And now he says the name Yosef. And he says, I am Yosef who you sold into Mitzrayim. How could he have known that? He couldn't have. That's impossible. He knows the details of the story. So that's the proof, says Ramban. It's not the language. Piha medaber means, look who's telling you, ani Yosef. Look who's telling you, asher machartem, you sold me. It's not the style, it's not the language, it's the substance. It's what he said. That was the proof. Ani Yosef, asher machartem, achechem, asher machartem. How else would they know? And he says, you see that I can give commands, you see that I'm in charge. You see all this, you see? So, that's what you should go home and tell your father. Now, from the Ramban's way of explaining this, we really have a problem with the Medrash. Because the Medrash's entire proof rests on the notion that Pi HaMedaber Aleichem means Yosef spoke Hebrew, and that was somehow compelling. So, incidentally, the Baal HaTurim says, and this is also brought down by the Peter Sharekeach HaLateri says the same thing, only the Baal HaTurim, of course, finds it in code, because that was his specialty. He says, Baal HaTurim says the words Ki Pi HaMedaber Aleichem have the same gematria, have the same numeric equivalent as the words Be'egla Arufa. Egla Arufa is a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah in the Torah that if a person is discovered murdered, a corpse is found, so they have to make a big kerfuffle out of this. And it goes to the closest city, and the elders have to bring a young calf, and the calf has to be beheaded in either a river or a brook that's running with great force, or very hard ground that had never been plowed before. And the elders have to wash their hands on this decapitated calf, and they have to say, Yodeinu leshafchus adam azeh. And the Sefer HaChinuch, similar things also found also in the Rambam's Moreh Nevuchim, explains that this was about creating a conversation, making a big deal out of this, so that the unsolved murder would get solved. Because otherwise we just get swept under the carpet. A corpse was found, a corpse was buried, nobody talks about it, nothing ever happens. But if there's a big deal, and the elders feel responsible, and they're washing their hands, no, everybody talks about it, the murderer will be apprehended and brought to justice. But at any rate, this was the last halacha that Yaakov Avinu was studying together with Yosef. Rashi mentions this when it says, Vayar Yaakov sa'agalot, Yaakov Avinu saw the wagons, and it says, Vatchi Ruach Yaakov Avihem. Yaakov saw the wagons, and he said, ah, now I can live again. Some people think it means that Yaakov saw his son is driving a fancy car. He says, now I feel like a mensch again. But that's not what it means. Of course not. What does it mean, Vayar Sagolus? Yosef was sending a message to his father. I know what you think. You think I got lost in Egypt. You think I'm totally assimilated. You think I forgot the things you taught me. I still remember the last lesson that we study together. Egla Rufa. So the Balaturim says, Pi Hamedaber means Egla Rufa. And he said to them, you want to know it's me? You want to be sure? He says, go back and ask Yaakov what the last subject we studied together was. Who else could know that? Who else could know the last subject they studied together? Yosef says, Egla Rufa. And they know, oh, you know Egla Rufa? Yeah, I know about Egla Rufa. How is an Egyptian viceroy supposed to know about Egla Rufa? Now, incidentally, the Chatam Sofer says that based on this Balaturim, we could explain the question, we could answer the question of the Ramban. Because Ramban's question was, how is that a proof if he could speak Hebrew? But he didn't just speak Hebrew. He knew the nuances of Hebrew. There's a big difference between speaking Hebrew and between being able to speak the Hebraic code, being able to use what we call in the legal field legalese. He speaks a Lumdisha language. He can speak Torah language. He can use gematria. He can use allusion. He can use various levels until he gets down to the meat of the subject. He say in Yiddish, et hatmet ze geret in lernen. He spoke to them in learning. He said, this is not an Egyptian prince. He knows how to learn. He knows our language. He knows how to go like this with his finger when he's learning Gemara. He doesn't just know a language academically. So it's like people learn Yiddish in university. I don't even know why they do that, but it's like a curio. Like, I speak Yiddish, like, you know, because I spoke Yiddish before I speak English. And like I learned Torah in Yiddish. And let me tell you, their Yiddish is not my Yiddish. It's like, it's strange, theatrical Yiddish that we don't speak. Hasidim speak Yiddish, learn Torah. It's a Torah Yiddish. That's a, you know, I know Yiddish. Did I ever spoken Yiddish? I know Yiddish. It's not the same language. So Yosef didn't speak in some kind of strange dialect of Hebrew. He spoke a Yiddish Hebrew. He spoke in learning. Ah, they said, oh, Pi Hamedaber. You see? Of course. So he says in that way, Chatam Sofer says, based on the words of the Balaturim and the Rokeach, Ramban's question really falls away. And maybe that's even fits into Ramban's answer. Ramban's answer says, he says, I'm Yosef. How would he know his name? So now it's even better. And not just I'm Yosef. Let me tell you the last thing we learned about. And let me tell you how we talked about it. And they could see this without a question. Okay, so now we know how the Medrash then is bringing this proof that the identifying mark for Yosef was the language. But not academically, but he spoke the language. As they say, like, Egeret Azaftik in Yiddish. He spoke a Hebrew, like a Yiddish a Hebrew. So, oh, that kind of Hebrew he speaks. He must be a Jew. Okay. So now we know that the Jewish people spoke Hebrew. When Moshe Rabbeinu came and he gave them his first sermon, what language did he speak to them in? In Hebrew. And nobody had a problem understanding him. Moshe Rabbeinu speaks Hebrew.
Huh? That's proof in itself.
That's proof of?
In itself.
He's addressing the people in Hebrew. Must be to speak Hebrew, right?
Yeah, so you don't have to have all this back.
Okay, that's interesting. That could be interesting proof. Okay, so now let me share with you the words of the Maharsha. The Maharsha is one of the greatest Talmudists of the 16th century. And his commentaries are studied assiduously. Any student who calls himself a remote Gemara student has learned Maharsha. There's the Gemara, Rashi Tosfos, that's from the era of the Rishonim, and then closing of that era is to learn Tosfos or Rashi, you have to learn Maharsha. Rabbeinu Shmuel Idlish, you have to learn Maharsha. By the way, Maharsha study is very difficult. He was not an expert linguist. Clearly, he did not speak Hebrew. And somebody once told me that there's a trick to learning Maharsha. And the trick is, if you use Yiddish grammar, when you read the Hebrew, it actually kind of fits and makes sense. Maharsha spoke Yiddish. That was his spoken language. But he wrote in Hebrew. But he wrote as he was thinking in Yiddish, translating the words into Hebrew, into Lashon HaKodesh. So, Maharsha writes the following. He says, the Targum, it says, the Gemara in Megillah says, that the Torah was given to us along with its interpretation, along with the Targum. So Maharsha says, HaTargum hu Lashon Aramis. The Targum is Aramaic, which it actually is. That's the Targum Unculus.
Targum Yonasu ben Uziel, even the Targum Yerushalmi. It's our, all the Targumim, which are not just simply translations, but rather interpretive translations, they're all written in Aramaic. So Marsha says that this is in Aramit, because Vadai Nitna Bilshon HaKodesh, for sure the Torah was given in the holy tongue. What's the holy tongue? Hebrew. Hu Lashon Ivri, this is the language of Ivri. We got this Me'avotenu from our ancestors. Me'evar Hanar from the other side, who came from the other side of the river. He says, but Pirusha Misinai Hoya, the explanation of the Torah from Sinai was the Targum, which is Lashon Aramit. And why was this? Because the Jewish people, in order to understand the Hebrew, had to get an interpretation in Aramit. And he says, because Mirugolim boy mibeis avi imam, they were speaking this language, they were used to this language from their maternal grandfather. Who is the maternal grandfather of the Shvatim? The maternal grandfather? Lavan. Lavan is called Lavan Ha'arami. Why is he called Lavan Ha'arami? Because he comes from Aram. And in Aram, they speak Aramit. So therefore, he says, the people didn't really speak Hebrew. And if they got Torah in Hebrew, they wouldn't understand the Torah. So that's why the Torah was given with a Targum, because what they really understood was the Aramit language. So according to what the Marsha says here, what language did the Jewish people speak? Aramit, not Lashon HaKodesh. Which means that if we had an identifying mark that we had a language, we spoke our own language and nobody else understood, what language was it? Sounds like Aramit. Of course, the problem is that the Marsha seems to contradict himself. And this is in Maseches Sanhedrin, on page 21, side B, the Marsha says the following. He speaks about the idea of Hebrew and Aramit. And he says that the language of Aramit is called Livuna'a, also known as Livuna'a, and the reason it's called Livuna'a is because Lavan, exactly. And he says, this is also why the language of Hebrew is called Lashon Ivri, because it comes Me'evar HaNohar. So Aramit is the language of Lavan. And that's why we read in the Torah that there was a pile of stones when Lavan parted from his son-in-law, daughters, and grandchildren, never to see them again, built a big wall, and he called the wall Yigar Sahadusa. Yigar Sahadusa, which is written in the Torah, is the language of Aramit, Aramaic. And we know Lavan's called an Arami because we read in the Haggadah, Arami Ovidavi. So it's right in the Torah. V'locheni says, therefore, Nitno HaTorah Metchila B'Ksav Ivri. The Torah was given in Hebrew writing. Shuksav shehurgalu b'Yisrael, that this is the script that the people were used to, mi'avi imam lavan, which means, he says, the original script that was used, according to this opinion in the Gemara, was not the Hebrew script that we have today, but rather the paleo, what they call paleo Hebrew, which was the way Aramaic was written. They didn't have the square letters that we have today. There's many opinions about this. We follow the opinion that the Torah was given in the Aleph Bet letter that we have today. But all of the ancient stone chiseling has been found is Paleo Hebrew. It's not, there's virtually no paper left. The oldest paper or parchment we have is from the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they are actually in Hebrew, but that's from a much later time. But Marsha says, Avaloshon HaKodesh, but the holy tongue, that Hurgulu Me'avihem Yaakov, that they got from Yaakov, who called the pile of stones not Yigar Sahadusa, but rather Gal Eid, Lehutzichul Lashon Aramis. They didn't need the Aramic tongue. So the same Marsha, in his commentary on Masechet Megillah, says that the Jewish people spoke Aramaic in Egypt. And the same Marsha, in Masechet Sanhedrin, tells us that the Jewish people spoke Lashon HaKodesh, spoke Hebrew. He says they wrote in Aramit language. They use Aramit cursive.
But the language, the words, the substance, the content was Lashon HaKodesh.
And so, my dear friends, I pose the question to you tonight. What is the Medrash talking about when the Medrash says that the Jewish people kept their unique language? What was their unique language? Now, in the Medrash, it seems to be that it must be Lashon HaKodesh, because the Medrash proves it from Pi HaMedaber. And Pi HaMedaber is both style and substance. Yosef speaking Hebrew in speaking about Torah subjects. Now, the Jewish people weren't talking Torah subjects anymore, but they still were speaking Hebrew, or so we think. And yet, here the Marsha is telling us that they spoke Aramaic, and here's telling us they spoke Hebrew. Which language did we speak? Will the real Jewish language please rise? This is the question I'm posed to you tonight. So, let me share with you a fascinating secret. And this secret appears first in a book which is known, Sefer HaKuzari, the book of the Khazar. So here is the history. There was an area in the Caspian Sea, an ancient kingdom known as Khazaria. Khazaria was a real kingdom that once existed that was overrun by foreign invaders. Most of the Khazarian people were either slaughtered or assimilated. There is no independent place called Khazaria today. The land that was once Khazaria was occupied by the Soviet Union with the rise of communism. And one of the mitzvahs that the Soviets did was wipe out any trace of Khazarian civilization so that you should know you are Sovietskaya. You have to know you're Soviet and the rest doesn't make a difference. And they actually built a dam over the capital city of the Khazarians, which was an archaeological dig. They built an enormous dam, so whatever was there was washed away. We know quite a bit about the Khazars. The king of the Khazars was known as a Kagan, or a Kagan Bek. And the Kagan Bek, or the Kagan, this very important individual, was kind of sandwiched between East and West. They were still a pagan country, but all of the lands around them had become enlightened. To their west was the Christian lands. Christianity had taken root and replaced all the pagan religions. To the east, Islam had replaced all the pagan religions. And so the Kagan Bek decided it was time for Khazaria to get itself a religion. What should we choose? Should we go east or should we go west? Should we be Christian or should we be Muslim? We have to be, you know, modernize things. We have to catch up to everybody else and now have proper civilization and culture instead of being a relic, a handover from once upon a time. So they thought the truth must be in the east or west. I mean, the truth is either Christianity or it's either Islam. But the curious thing was that the more he researched Christianity and Islam, it kept coming back to the Jews. He said, well, the Jews can't be right because the Jews are just a broken people, an exiled ancient people. They can't be right. God can't favor them. That was the favorite argument of the church. All of the cathedrals of Europe were graced with two statues. A triumphant Juno-esque looking statue whose name is Christina. And next to it was a broken, beaten-looking person. And you guessed it. Her name was Synagoga. And that adorned every, till today, by the way. You can still go to Europe and see it. That's the anti-Semitism of centuries long. Make it very clear. The triumphant Christianity is triumphant, and Israel is vanquished. The Romans said Judea Capta, and then when Rome became the Holy Roman Empire, quote-unquote, and it evolved into Christendom, there was this need to put down the Jews because, after all, we came from the Jews. So it can't be that still right. God must have abrogated his covenant, and now this we're the new Jews. Okay, so the Khazarian king was a pretty smart guy, and he says something doesn't make sense over here. We keep coming back to Jews. So he figured, okay, I'm going to have this big imam come. I'll have a priest come. You know, he called Mecca. He said, Mecca, I have a problem. Please send me a wise man. No problem. He called Rome. Rome, send me a wise man. He called Jerusalem. Jerusalem was in ruins. I don't know where he got a Jew from, but he found a rabbi from somewhere. And he's going to interview them. And the Kagan Bek eventually is so amazed by what the rabbi says that he converts to Judaism, even though that was never really in the running. Not only he converted to Judaism, but all of the nobility of Khazaria converted to Judaism. And then we don't really know if the common populace converted to Judaism also. Of course, Arthur Costa wrote his ridiculous book called The 13th Tribe, claiming that all of European Jewry is just Khazars. What's Khazars? And so I'm going to tell you that I read the book, and it's full of stupidity, full of narishkeit. And one of the most silly things that he wrote, this is supposed to be a very intelligent, well-heeled, educated guy, he has this chapter about the sheitel. He says the Jewish women, they cover their hair. So what they do is they cut their hair before they get married and make a wig out of it. Well, Mr. Kostler, that's actually not a kosher sheitel. It's got to be somebody else's hair. So the big chacham is not actually such a chacham, because anything I read about that I didn't know about sounded really good. But all the things he wrote about the things that I know about, they were like all wrong. Anyway, but his theory is gone. Do you know why his theory is gone? You know, how could you disprove it? It's called genetic science. The DNA has come out, the DNA evidence. And the DNA evidence shows that we are overwhelmingly from the Middle East. And furthermore, the DNA shows that Jews living in Northern Europe and Jews living in Northern Africa, each who look respectively just like their neighbors, are almost identical genetically. So the superficial epigenetic changes of skin color and jaw shape actually are a very, very small part of the genetics. And the vast majority of the genetics is identical. So Sephardim, Ashkenazim, Europeans, North Africans, we all come from the same place. So that whole theory is gone. What did happen to the Khazars? So first of all, probably the whole kingdom did not convert. Probably a very small part of the kingdom converted. There's probably just the nobility. The serfs remained serfs. And a lot of them were murdered. A lot of them were massacred. And some of the Khazars ended up in Hungary, and they say that there is a percentage of Hungarian Jewry that may have Khazarian converts amongst them. It's a very, very small percentage. But anyway, they were, it was Gerim Kalach, and they're 100% Jewish. What did the rabbi argue? What did he actually tell the king? We don't know. What was the rabbi's name? We don't know. There is a number of letters that are still extant. I think they're found in Oxford University, letters that were written from the Spanish Jewish community to the Khazarian community, halachic questions. So we have compelling evidence. We know they existed. What the rabbi was and who, we don't know. However, Rabbi Yehuda ben Shmuel HaLevi, the famous Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, the great Jewish poet and linguist, was one of the great Rishonim. Vilna Gaon writes about his book that it's a foundational book of Jewish ideas. The Hasidic masters embraced his book and based many of their teachings on the philosophies of the Khazari. It's one of the earliest books of Jewish philosophy. He wrote what we would call today historical fiction. He said, imagine I was that man. Imagine I was that rabbi. What kind of questions would they have asked me? And how would I have answered those questions? And so he distilled the Jewish philosophy, the Torah philosophy of his time, into this compelling story called Sefer HaKhazari. Okay, now you know what the Khazari book is? Good. So in Maamar Sheni, in the second major discourse of the Sefer HaKhazari, in the 68th chapter, he talks about the language of Ivri. And the Khazari says that it does not make sense to say that it was called the language of Ivri, because the language came Me'evar HaNohar. The Evar HaNohar, the other side of the river, is the Euphrates. The Euphrates was a point of demarcation between the Chaldeans, the Aramit people, Kazdim, and the Canaanim. So Avram came from Aramit. He couldn't have come speaking Hebrew. They don't speak Hebrew. What did the Kazdians speak? They speak Aramit. So where do we get the term Ivri from? So the Khazari says that the Hebrew tongue was passed down from Adam Harishon. Adam and Chava spoke Hebrew. That was the language God taught them. And it went dor achar dor until the son of Noah. The son of Noah's name was Aver. And it's the grandson of Noah, pardon me. Right? The son of Noah is Shem. Shem is the heir of Noah, Noah's spirituality. Who promulgates those teachings, the teachings of Noah and later the teachings of Shem? Aver. What's the yeshiva that Yaakov studied, and what was it called? Shem v'Aver. So he says, because Aver was kind of the final recipient, final non-Jewish recipient of this language, who does he get passed off to? Avram. So therefore,
he says Lashon Eiver, uba'avur Roy, it was because of Eiver that it's called Ivrit. Ivrit comes from Lashon Eiver. And he says that's because when Eiver was a child, that's when all the other languages began. That was the Dor HaHaflaga, came in the time of Eiver. So up until Eiver, everybody spoke Hebrew. But then everybody started speaking a cacophony of languages. And the only one left speaking Hebrew was Eiver. So since Eiver was the only one left speaking Hebrew, the language of Eiver became known as Ivrit. Which actually makes perfect sense. Does it make sense to say, you can call Avraham an Ivri because he comes from Eiver HaNor. You can't call his language Ivrit. And so the Kuzari says like this. It's unbelievable. That's what he says. V'kvar haya Avraham medaber aramit bu'ur kazdim. When Avraham lived in Ur Kazdim, what language did he speak? Aramit. Sha'aramit u'lashoyin kazdim. The Chaldean spoke Aramaic. Kuzari goes on to say, he says, Ha'ivrit lashon miyuchedet. It's a special language. Lashon ha'kodesh. It's the holy tongue. Aramit lashon chol. Aramit was an everyday, pedestrian, ordinary tongue. And so, the commentary, Oitzer Nechmad, which is one of the commentaries on the Kuzari, he says like this. He says, if you think that Avraham Avinu was born speaking Hebrew, think again. That makes no sense, he says. he was born and he grew up in Ur Kazdim. His father Terach was an idolater. How would he speak Lashon HaKedesh? Al-Karchach says the Oitzer Nechmad Hayim Medaber Kilashoin Amoy. Avraham Avinu spoke the language of his nation. What language was that? Lashon Kazdim. Aramit. Like it says in Sefer Daniel. And he learned that was the language of Avraham Avinu's youth, was the language of Aramit. Now he says, Avalomad Lashon HaKodesh Mi Eiver. He learned the Holy Tongue from Eiver. And he learned the Holy Tongue from Eiver, who learned it from his father and from his father's father, from Shem and from Noach. So therefore, Avraham Avinu became bilingual. Who knew Abraham was a Canadian? He spoke two languages. But he didn't say the same thing twice like federal politicians. What did he use two languages for? He says Avraham Avinu hishtamesh bo l'kedusha. He used the Hebrew tongue for holy pursuit, holy matters. V'aramit etzloi l'shoin chol. Aramit he used to speak mundane languages. And it depends on what Avinu was doing. That's what language he would speak. That's what he was speaking about. He was selective. He says, he would never have used a holy language to speak holy, mundane things. On the contrary, he says. And that's why Avram went back and forth. The Kol Yehuda, who's another very important commentary on the Sefer Kuzari, says that Avram showed up in Eiver's yeshiva, and Avram was the special student. He was the special student. That means Noach taught Shem, Shem taught Eiver, and Eiver taught Avram. And because Avram was such a chassid of his teacher Eiver, what did he end up getting called? Avraham HaIvri. That's why it was called Avraham HaIvri. Because of his connection to the man who taught him Torah, which is Noach, Shem, and ultimately Eiver. So it comes out that there were two languages being spoken. The Kuzari goes on to say that the languages are very similar. He says Arabic, Aramaic, and Hebrew are very, very similar. But he says, Lashon ha'ivris levada mu'ula shabahem. The cleanest, most perfect language, that's the Hebrew one. And because of this, there's language, he says, there is shared language. There are many things where there's overlap. In fact, even in today, in Hebrew and Arabic, there's shared languages. You can pick up Arabic words if you know Hebrew. Aramaic. If you learn Gemara and you review the Parsha, you know how to speak Aramaic, you see the Aramaic root in the Hebrew. Very, very similar. But the Hebrew, that's the holy and the perfect tongue.
So now, based on this knowledge that we have, that Avraham Avinu spoke not one but two languages, and he spoke the two languages depending on what he was doing, the Yaivitz explains that Avraham Avinu passed this on to his children. And he said, we don't use the Hebrew tongue, the holy tongue, for mundane things. We use the holy tongue for holy things, the mundane tongue for mundane things. And because of this, he wanted shelo lezalzel b'kedushata. He did not want to demean the language. He didn't want to, in a way, lower the language. This was nivdelet lahakdisha kodesh kadoshim hi Lashem. Avraham Avinu understood that this language should be sanctified and dedicated in the holiest fashion for God. So what did Avraham Avinu use the language for? Can't be when he taught people Torah because the people he was talking to didn't speak that language. It could be when he spoke or taught Torah to Yitzchak or to Yaakov. But this is how Avraham Avinu prayed. Avraham Avinu prayed daily in Hebrew. Whenever he would speak to God, it would be in Hebrew. His songs of praise to God would be in Hebrew. His study of Torah on his own would be in Hebrew. And Hebrew is a holy language that has an impact and a power that can actually transform reality. If Avraham did this, what do you think Yitzchak did? What his father told him to do? What do you think Yaakov did? What do you think Yaakov's children did? So what was the Jewish way? We were bilingual. In a time when most of the people in the world could barely speak one language and nobody could read and write, we were bilingual. How cool is that? We're speaking two languages. Now here's the problem. At some point, our ancestors in Mitzrayim stopped doing holy things. They stopped talking to God. They stopped praying to God. So what languages were they left with? They were left with Hebrew, but they were left with Aramaic. And so now there was some kind of, if you want to be realistic, we're going to call it jargon, which is a word for a name for Yiddish. You know what jargon means? A jargon of languages. The Jewish people spoke in Mitzrayim a cacophony of languages, a cacophony of two languages. They mixed together Aramaic and Hebrew. And that's why, the Marsha says, writing wasn't so common. So what language did they end up writing in? The characters they used were Aramaic, at least according to one opinion in the Gemara. But they still were fluent in Hebrew. They still could understand Hebrew. When Moshe Rabbeinu showed up and he gave them a sermon in Hebrew, they could understand what he was saying. At the same time, when it came to studying Torah, they couldn't speak Hebrew very well. They didn't have a great grasp of the language. They were like your typical European Jew of 100 years ago. He could write Hebrew. Every Talmud Chacham could write Hebrew. But when he wanted to really explain himself, how did he explain himself? In Yiddish. That was the common way of doing it. In the time of the Gemara, the sages spoke Hebrew, yet the Gemara is written in the language of Aramaic. Why? Because that's the language they really understood. So when you really, really understand something, it's got to be in a language you feel a full fluency with. The Torah is holy, it's given in Hebrew. But the Targum that was given at Sinai, who do you need a Targum for? The answer is for the Jewish people. To really learn and study the Torah, for this they have to use Aramaic. So now we discover the secret. We say the Jewish people were speaking Jewish languages. They were. Two Jewish languages. And very interestingly, that has been the experience of the Jewish people in exile. And it was even the Jewish people's experience in Israel, where Hebrew was used for prayer, Hebrew was used for Torah, but Hebrew was not used as the common language. What was the common spoken language of the Jewish people during the Second Temple era? Aramaic. And so it was when the Jewish people moved, they had a Hebraized Arabic that they used. Reb Sadji Gaon's Arabic is not a typical Arabic. Ladino in Spain, and Yiddish in Germany and most of Europe. And this was not an accident. This was choreographed. Why couldn't we have spoken Hebrew? Somebody didn't let us speak Hebrew. If you could speak Yiddish, you could speak Hebrew. They didn't want to speak Hebrew. They said that's not the way we should follow. And incidentally, spoken languages also change. All spoken languages change. Because spoken languages change, if you speak in Hebrew, what happens to Hebrew? It changes. The one thing we don't want to do in the Torah is make changes. So therefore, we were careful to speak other languages, Jewish languages. We had our own language. Germans do not understand Yiddish. You know why Germans don't understand Yiddish? Because like 50% of the words are actually Hebrew or Aramaic. They tell a story that there was a rabbi in Germany who had to testify in a court of law. And he said, I don't speak German. I can't testify. So they said to him, speak Yiddish. It's German. So he got up there and he said, the Jewish people were circumcised and the non-Jewish people were not circumcised. So how did he refer to as a Gentile? The Gentile made an accusation and he had to testify that what the Gentile was saying was not true. He said, the Goy, Goy is a nation, it's Yiddish. They're Oral. Okay, Oral means guys uncircumcised. Again, Hebrew. Zogt Sheker Muchlat. He says, absolute lies. Dem MS, he says, the MS, which is the truth, is, and the rest of the sentence was something else, more like a bunch of Aramaic words. So it didn't work, basically, because the words you think of as Yiddish are actually Hebrew. Like, let's talk about some famous Hebrew words. Well, famous Yiddish words everybody knows. Shlomazel. Yeah, Shlomazel. Everybody knows Shlomazel, but Shlomazel is just the words Shaloi Mazal. He has got no luck. He's the hapless, luckless guy. Right? The Shlomazel spills the soup. The Shlomiel gets the soup spilled on him. So so that's what the Shlomazel is. He just has no mazel. It's a Yiddish word. It's a Hebrew word, I mean. It's a Hebrew word, that's all it is. You know the food we make on Shabbos called chalant? You know what it really is? It's a Hebrew word, shalon, who spent the night. Lina means to spend the night. What's unique about the chalant? It's the only food that spends the night in the oven. And so on and so forth. So now I want to introduce you to a very interesting twist in all of this. Very interesting twist in all of this is, it seems like Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't even speak Egyptian. It seems like Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't even speak Egyptian. Because when Moshe Rabbeinu first gets the command to go and to speak to the Pharaoh, what was Moshe Rabbeinu's response to God? In Exodus 4, verse 10. What does Moshe Rabbeinu say to God? He says, Be Adoni, please, my master, Loi ish dvarim anoichi. I am not a man of many words. I'm not a communicator. And he says, Kvad peh. I am heavy of tongue. Which Rashi says means he stammers. However, the Chizkuni, who was a great Rishon, writes, Kvad peh. He says, and I quote, Lofisha barachti mi Mitzrayim bikatnusi. Because I ran away from Egypt when I was a child. Va'achshav, and now, ben shmonim shana anochi, now I'm 80 years old. He says, v'kvar shachachti loshem mitzri. I forgot how to speak Egyptian. I don't really speak Egyptian. Aval Aaron lo zoz misham. Aaron never left Egypt. And therefore, v'yodea lishonim. He knows, he speaks their language. So what language did Aaron speak to the Pharaoh? He spoke to him in Egyptian. How do we know this? The sages tell us so. The Mechilta de Rashbi, on this week's Parsha, in which Moshe Rabbeinu finally gets the command, where God says to him, you will be a god to the Pharaoh. Ramban says he'll look at you like a god, like far out. Aaron will be your prophet. A god has a prophet. So you'll be like off the charts, and he'll be your communicator. The Mechilta de Rashbi, and I'm quoting, says like this. Rashbi, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, he wrote a Mechilta. He wrote a Medrash Halacha on Genesis. He says, Omar Loi, God said to Moshe, Ata daber b'lashoin kodesh. You speak in Hebrew, kemalach, like an angel. Incidentally, the Ibn Ezra interprets the words, you will be as a god, he says, you'll be a malach, you'll be like an angel. So Rashbi, the Mechilta Rashbi says, Moshe Rabbeinu would come in front of the Pharaoh and he would speak in Hebrew.
Aaron achicha yedaber b'loshen Mitzri. Aaron is going to speak Egyptian. And that's the meaning of you'll be a god, he'll be a prophet. You'll speak Hebrew, he'll speak Egyptian. So what value was it? So the Rebbe explains. When Moshe Rabbeinu walked in front of the Pharaoh and began to speak the words of Hashem, exactly as he heard them, the Pharaoh was totally shaken up because he was getting like an unadulterated prophecy from God, because that's Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu is totally transparent. He doesn't color the message. And that shook the Pharaoh up. And after that carpet bombing, then Aaron came along and said, let me explain what he said. There is a problem in this thesis. And the problem in this thesis is that when Moshe Rabbeinu himself sees a group of women who are being attacked and abused and tormented, he comes to their aid. Do you know how old he is at the time? If my memory does not fail me, he had to be 69. Because he was with Yisroel for 11 years. What's the first thing he does? How does he meet Yisroel? He's in 9 or 11 years. Either he was 71 or 69. How did he meet? Because he saw the girls being tormented. Why were they tormenting the girls? What do you mean? Because Yisroel doesn't believe in our God anymore. So let's torment his girls. So they tormented the girls, and Moshe Rabbeinu saved the girls. And what does it say about Moshe Rabbeinu then? Ishmitzri. Ishmitzri. Why did they call him Ishmitzri? He wasn't coming from Egypt. He was coming from Eritrea, from Eretz Kush. When Moshe Rabbeinu, after running away from Egypt, he ran south. He ran to Eritrea, which bordered Eretz Kush, not Ethiopia. Eritrea bordered Egypt. And there Moshe Rabbeinu joined the armed forces. And then the Medrash says he became a commander. And ultimately the four-star, a five-star commander. And ultimately the commander-in-chief, the king of Eritrea. And then after a few decades of that, he said, I think I'll go back to a quiet life. More conducive to prophecy and holiness. So he decided that he would leave Eritrea, but they wouldn't leave him alone. So he went to Midian, which is he head in the easterly direction, over the Yam Suf. And there he thought nobody would bother him, and he'd be able to devote himself to some quiet pursuit so he could restore his own spirit. And then he saw these girls being tormented. So he really isn't coming from Egypt at the time. He's coming from Eritrea, and I'm sure he picked up the language if he was the commander-in-chief of the king. So, but what language did he use? He used Egyptian. So here's a fascinating comment from Ruchaim Paltiel, who was a great Rishon. This is also found in some of the other Rishonim. I think Sari Bala Tesfa say the same thing. It says, Yosef, at the very end of the book of Genesis, Joseph says in verse 25 of chapter 50, he says, when I die, you buried me here, but God's going to remember you. What happens when you leave this country? What should you do? V'ha'alitem et atzmotai mizeh. You're going to raise up my bones. Okay. So the Chaim Paltiel asks Tema, ma zochu atzmas Yosef, Yosef mishol Moshe. Why did Yosef's bones get more credit, so to speak, than Moses' bones? Why were Moses' remains interred in the land of Israel? Why did Moses have to remain on the other side? He says something unbelievable. V'yeshleimar, Reb Chaim suggests, Moshe kofar l'shoinoi. Moshe did not remain loyal to his language. Kishe Yosef ala be'er, when he was sitting on the well, ubo b'nos Yisro, the daughters of Yisro came, dibru l'shoin mitzvus. He spoke to them in Egyptian. But Yosef lo kofar l'shono. He never changed his language. As he says, ki gunav gonavti, when he told the Pharaoh of being pulled out of the pit, out of the jail to interpret the dreams, he said, I was told me, Eretz ha-Ivrim, from the land of the Hebrews. So here, you're telling me Moshe Rabbeinu clearly spoke Egyptian. That's what the Chaim Paltiel says. And here, he's saying, Chuzkuni is saying, Kvad Peh means, I don't know the language. I don't know how to speak Hebrew. By the way, Rashbam, Rashi's grandson, Ibn Ezra, say the same thing. He doesn't know how to language. So here's my humble suggestion. Moshe Rabbeinu spoke. He spoke Egyptian. You know what he spoke Egyptian like? Like a greener who came from Europe, retta English. Moshe Rabbeinu said, I haven't spoken, you know, articulately in Egyptian for like, I don't know, 60 years. I don't remember the language well. He says, I can't speak to the Pharaoh. I speak broken Egyptian. It's not like my Zaydi grew up in Russia. You think he ever spoke Russian properly? To me, it sounded like he spoke a great Russian. The Russians told me he didn't speak Russian. So that's somebody Ashtetl Russian, whatever. Okay, English. So really, turns out that Aaron spoke not only a broken English or Egyptian, but Aaron spoke a beautiful Egyptian. Moshe Rabbeinu's Egyptian was weak. For Yisro's daughters, it worked. It's like, I can go into the halls of power. I'm going to go give a speech in front of the king, and I can't even speak the language well. I'm speaking in broken Egyptian. So it turns out that the Jewish people actually in the land of Egypt spoke three languages. They were trilingual. We were pretty smart even back then. We spoke Egyptian when we dealt with the Egyptians. We spoke Aramaic when we dealt with each other. And we spoke Hebrew. We were speaking three languages well. At least Aaron spoke it well. Which leads us into another very interesting point and a proof that Moshe Rabbeinu was dealing with a people who spoke Egyptian well. How do we know he spoke Egyptian well? Well, because the Torah uses Egyptian words. Why does the Torah use Egyptian words? Because it wants to convey something that's difficult to convey. It reaches for a word that the people would be familiar with. I'll give you two examples. We're in the desert. We have no food. We're getting really nervous. Like, all human beings need food, and we're just like everybody else, only a little more so. Jews without food, it's not a good situation. And we're like really, really nervous. We're like, Moses, there's no matzah left. What do we do now? Hashem says, you relax. Parshas B'Shalach. Don't worry. There's going to be food coming, raining down from the heavens. What happens? The food falls. Chapter 16, verse 15. Vayiru b'nei Yisrael, the Jewish people saw the food. Vayoymer ish el achiv, one man said to the other, Monhu. It's manna. It's manna. Why did they call it man? Because it was man, right? What they called it what it is. What do you call bread? Bread. Why do you call it bread? Because it's bread, right? Well, the pasuk says, no, they called it man ki lo yodu mahu, because they don't know what to call it. You can only call something that you had a frame of reference for. My father once told me that, he was a little baby, he doesn't remember this, but he talked about it, that in the DP camp, when Nebuch, where these, all our grandparents were, they never saw peanut butter in their life. How did they say peanut butter? So these big tins of U.S. Army peanut butter showed up. They had to feed the people. Nobody knew what to do with it. So one guy said, it must be something for the skin. Because, peanut butter gets like oil on top. He was trying to rub his hands with peanut butter. It didn't go until finally somebody explained Nebuch to these poor refugees. He says, no, this is peanut butter. You put it on bread. He says, bread, it's oil. They don't know what it is. They didn't know what it is. When I was in yeshiva, one of the first Russian students came out of the Soviet Union. It was still the Soviet Union. This is talking 1988. A boy named Avrom Benyonson came. I haven't seen him in like decades. And this kid landed from, he was a Balchuk from Russia, landed in yeshiva. He was just like we heard the stories of Russian boys from like 1930. He looked exactly like that. He had eyeglasses that were made by hand. And anyway, so I like adopted this kid. I didn't know what's going on. He just wanted to learn. He sat in the yeshiva, started learning right away. Learned he could, that he could do. He spoke Hebrew, a little Yiddish, he could learn. I took him to the lunchroom. First day he was there. And there was bananas. Like, so he took a banana, and he started to just eat the banana. I'm like, Avram, was tust du? Ma tausse? He looked at me quizzically. He said, what is this? He never saw a banana in his life. Anybody from the Soviet Union? How do you get to see a banana? He never saw a banana. I said, you're supposed to peel it. And I explained to him how you peel a banana. He says, oh. He says, thank you. It didn't taste good before. Like, you don't know what it was. Here the Jewish people, I got manna. And they have a name for it. They call it manna. You know what the pasuk says? No. I can't have a name for it. Lo yadu mahu. Vayemer Moshe. Moshe said, "Hu alechem." This is bread. They go, "This is bread." Yeah, this is the bread Hashem lechem lachol. This is the bread God gave you. I know it doesn't look like bread. So, what does the word man mean? What is man? Is man? Man who? Man who sounds really good. Manna. But the next part of the verse says, "Ki lo yadu," because they don't know what it is. So, listen to this. The Medrash Lekachtov says, Bilashoin Mitzri, in Egyptian, Oimrim Mahu Monhu. So when they didn't know what to call something, what language did they fall back on? Egyptian. He spoke Egyptian. And then he says, Rashbam, Rashi's grandson, says, Lefi Shehu Lashoin Mitzri, because it was Egyptian. He's quoting the Medrash Lekachtov. And he says, listen to this. Uba'oto lashon hayu regilin. That was the language they were used to speaking. How many languages did our ancestors speak clearly? Three. Egyptian, really well. They spoke Egyptian really well. But they also knew how to speak Aramaic, and they also knew how to speak Hebrew, Lashon HaKodesh. So because this is what they said, and the Torah is recording what they said, Kasav Moshe ba'oseh lashon shamru. Moshe Rabbeinu wrote down the words that they said. And because he wrote down the words that they said, that's how it's preserved for posterity. So now, what did this food ended up being called? It ended up being called manna. But that was because they didn't know what manna was. They said in Egyptian, monhu. Here's something else interesting. Tefillin. Tefillin of the hand is called an ota sign. Tefillin of the head. Oh, that has a name already. What's the name of the tefillin of the head? Totafot. So the Tzor Hamor says that Totafot is an Egyptian word. It means something worn on the head. Egyptian word. He says like you would call sunglasses. Bate Einayim. I don't know what sunglasses looked like in those days, but it was called in Egyptian Tuataf. Or tataf. And since these are going to be in numerous compartments worn on the head, it gets called totafot. That's what he says. And he says, why did they use the word totafot? Because it was haita az milam for semet. It was a well-known word, umuvenet l'chol Yisrael sheheim yoytze Mitzrayim. They were people who came out of Egypt, and he wanted to make sure they understood him. So therefore, he spoke a language they knew well, which was Egyptian. Vehevinu Eisei, they understood him. Says the Tzor Hamor, Mitzara Hergel, because they were used to that. Not only that, but listen to this. The Psikta Rabasi says, when God gave us the Ten Commandments, and it's also brought down in the Medrash Tanchuma Yoshan, it says, Amar Rabbi Nechemiah. Rabbi Nechemiah says, Mahu Anoichi. In Hebrew, how do you say I? Ani. What's Anoichi? Lashem Mitzri hu. It's Mitzri. It's Egyptian. And he says, Lama Adavar Daima. That's what the Psikta says. What is it like? He said, a man whose son was captured by bandits, by Shaboim, and he was living with the bandits in the forest, and he forgot his language, and he became familiar with their language. What did he do? He started speaking the language. So when he met his son, he wanted to communicate with his son. How did he communicate with him? He had to speak the Ganav language, bandit language, because that's the language he was familiar with. Says the Psikta, Ka'achas HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yisrael, so God did with us, Oysen HaShonim Shal Yisrael B'Mitzrayim, Lamdu Sichasan Shal Mitzrayim. During those long years in Egypt, 2 centuries, long time, they learned Egyptian. Kishigol and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God redeemed them. He wanted to give them the Torah. So God wanted to get their attention. How do you say I in Mitzri? Anoch. So he said, Anoch. Anoch Mitzri. He said, Anoch. Aloshna Anoichi. The Bali HaToisveis maintained that it was not just the first word, but the entire Aseret HaDibrot were delivered in Egyptian. How could this be? Aseret HaDibrot, foundation of the whole Torah, was given in Egyptian. So want to tell me that the Targum was given in Egyptian? Okay. But The first word God ever spoke to the Jewish people. That's the word, and everybody depicts the luchos. The one word they write at full is anochi. It's an Egyptian word. Come on, I mean, they clearly understood Aramaic. They understood Hebrew. Figure it out. Work hard. Moshe Rabbeinu explained it to you after. Why would God use Egyptian? So here we have the beautiful explanation of Chassidus. Really, all the other explanations are kind of lackluster. Because at the end of the day, they spoke three languages. Why did they choose that language for? Okay, Toitofis is an unusual thing. And it was a problem in the beginning because we only had two parshiot. The tefillin of the head had four compartments. So in the beginning, for the first 39 years, the Jewish people wearing tefillin had two parchments and two empty compartments. And they only finished the tefillin off at the end of the 40 years. Okay, so, but he wanted to make clear that this was numerous compartments. They used an unusual word, fine. Mun, they didn't know what to say. They were in a moment of discombobulation. They go, Munhu! So Moshe Rabbeinu recorded it as they said it, Munhu, Mun. But Anoichi, Aseres HaDibros, Yalkut Shimon Yirem Ezeish Pevav says, quote, Anoichi Lashon Mitzri, straight up. So the Rebbe asked unbelievable questions. The Rebbe says, what's going on over here? About the Aseres HaDibros, he says, the Rebbe says, it is said, quote, Klolos Kol HaTorah. It represents the whole Torah. In other words, it includes the whole Torah. Rabbi Sadji Goren has a beautiful way of showing that everything in the whole Torah is alluded to in the words of Aseres HaDibros. And in the Aseres HaDibros themselves, so the first two Dibrot are the most powerful ones. We have the famous Gemara in Maseches Makos on page 24 that says to us, Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe. What's the numerical equivalent of the word Torah? Probably 613, right? No. The Gemara says 611. Moshe Rabbeinu instructed us about 611 mitzvahs. But there are 613. Right. The first two we heard from God Himself. So 611 through Moshe, the first two from God Himself. So one second, you're going to tell me that the most lofty of Aseret HaDibrot, God Himself speaking to us, had to be an Egyptian? Because we couldn't speak Hebrew, but we know we could speak Hebrew. We know we could. We were trilingual. Why did it have to be an Egyptian for? And for sure, the first word is like, you can't even imagine. The first word, the greatest gilui, the greatest revelation. How could it be in a language of Mitzri? It's not just any language. It's not just Aramit. It's not even a Jewish language. It's a profoundly un-Jewish language. It's like what we would think of as German today. German. Achtung German. Not Yiddish. These were the people who tormented us. This was the country that murdered our babies. And the Torah and Revelation has to come in their language? So the Rebbe says, there's a famous Gemara in Maseches Shabbos on page 88. And the Gemara says that when Moshe Rabbeinu came to get the Torah, the Malachim said, hey, one second. Put your glory on the heavens, they said, God. What are you giving Torah to them for? Give us your Torah. We'll understand your Torah. We'll appreciate your Torah. So God turned to Moshe and he said, you have any answer for them? Can you engage them? And the Gemara uses these euphemisms. Moshe is terrified. He's holding on to the throne of God, whatever that means. And Moshe turns around to him and says, tell me. It says, Anochi Hashem Elokecha asher hotzeisi eschem me'eretz Mitzrayim. He says, L'mitzrayim eratem, have you been to Egypt? You needed to be taken out of Egypt? In other words, the Torah is not about heaven. The Torah is about earth. The Torah is about bringing godliness down to earth. That is to say, the essence of Torah is not lofty, disconnected spirituality, but the essence of Torah is spirituality and holiness permeating the physical, the literal, the mundane, the ordinary, bringing heaven down to earth. And so, the Rebbe says, since that's the point of Torah, when the Malachim stand in Moshe Rabbeinu's way, what does he say to them? Did you go down? L'mitzrayim yoradatem? You didn't. You don't get the Torah. Because the Torah is not about escapism. The Torah is about engagement. The Torah is about transformation. The Torah is about actualizing holiness. And that message was given to the Jewish people as soon as they received the Torah by God specifically communicating with them in Egyptian.
Anoichi Hashem Elokecha, the Rebbe says. That's the message. To explain, to embody this idea, to convey this message, that the Torah comes from the highest places, but it's all about being brought down into the lowest common denominator. And very interestingly, what did Moshe Rabbeinu do in the last days of his life? He taught Torah. In what language?
70.
70 languages. For who? I saw some of Farshim say, well, the Erev Rav, they couldn't learn Hebrew in 40 years? Come on, there was no Ulpan over there? It doesn't take anybody 40 years to learn Hebrew. And how was Moshe Rabbeinu talking to them up until this time? Up until this now, it was all Greek to them. And the last few days of his life, he said, oh, now I want to make sure you hear it for me. So the Rebbe says that Torah is given to us in Hebrew. Torah is given in Hebrew. And Hebrew is the recipient, that's the receptacle of Torah. But ultimately, what did Moshe Rabbeinu, who empowered us to be able to study Torah and go forward with Torah, what did Moshe Rabbeinu want to give to us? The ability to bring holiness not only into the Hebrew language, but rather to bring holiness into the most common denominator, every language. In other words, Moshe Rabbeinu is the bridge. Moshe Rabbeinu, through whom Hashem gave the Torah, Moshe Rabbeinu is the one who devotes the last days of his life to translating the Torah, to speaking words of Torah in other languages, because ultimately the idea of Egyptian in the Torah is not because the people didn't speak or understand the Hebrew well, but rather because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted that Torah ideas should become part of the everyday, concrete, real world. And this is what the essence of the Torah is. So why is this all so important to us? It's all so important to us because on one hand, we preserve the authenticity and the sanctity of the Hebrew language. Lashon HaKodesh is used for Dvarim Kedoshim. We don't want to use it for mundane things. This is a true concept. But at the same time, the essence of Torah, the substance, the content, is something that has to permeate all languages and every convention. And this is how the languages of yesteryear very much impact and have everything to do with the life we should be living as Jewish people today. We should at once be apart, keeping ourselves separate from the comings and goings in the world. But at the same time, we have a sacred duty of being a part of civilization. In fact, taking a leadership role in modifying, in guiding, in elevating, in transforming the civilization and the world in which we live so that it will, Be'ezrat Hashem, become a receptacle and a convention for godliness with the coming of Mashiach. B'mheira will be Amenu. Amen.